From Iowa Public Radio, this is The Exchange. I'm Dean Borg, in for Ben Kiefer. We're beginning today's show with University of Iowa President Sally Mason. I'll ask her about the university's continuing efforts to recover from the floods of 2008 and also economic recession. And a conversation, too, about the university's partnership with this Iowa City to maintain the ordinance banning people under the age of 21 from bars after 10 o'clock at night. Later in the hour, host Catherine Perkins talks with the United States Department of Agriculture's Undersecretary for Rural Development. They'll discuss the ethanol blend in gasoline, broadband internet service, and much more. That's coming up on The Exchange right after this news. This is Exchange. I'm Dean Borg. I'm talking with the president of the University of Iowa, Sally Mason. Hello, President Mason.
Good to see you, Dean.
I must say that as I look back on your tenure here at the University of Iowa, if I'm right, you came to the presidency in August of 2007.
I did.
Lots happened between now and then. I look back, and it was, 10 months after that, and we had a massive flood through Iowa City. And you were just getting your feet on the ground
That's correct.
The University of Iowa, and then had that. It was really a challenging wake-up call. And then a recession and the budget adjustments. How is the University of Iowa right now in the wake of those two major challenges?
Well, you know, if you'd asked me this question 2 years ago, I'm sure I would have had a very different answer. Still suffering from the traumatic effects, after effects of the flood, as many of us here in Iowa City were suffering. That was a very, very tough time for a lot of people, myself included, and certainly the university included. But we've come through these disasters about as well as any entity I could possibly imagine. And I have to say that it's a real tribute to people and the people of Iowa City, the people of the University of Iowa. Pulling together as we did to get through the flood was, as I've now said and reflected upon, really good preparation for what was to follow, which was an economic downturn that most of us are not used to experiencing.
Wouldn't you have to say that the university is still reeling from those two very heavy body blows?
Well, we're in what I call active recovery phase, and we have a lot to look forward to. That's probably the most exciting thing, and perhaps what distinguishes us from many other universities around the country, mm-hmm. is that at the same time we were dealing with the budget crisis and certainly the downturn in budget, you know, if I put it in perspective for people, the flood was a $743 million event. Our budget problems have totaled, at their worst, about $65 million. So really, our focus and our efforts have been on flood renewal, flood recovery. We've stayed focused on the goal of making certain that the university would come back and come back better and stronger than before. And we're on target. It's going to take time, but we're on target.
You know, there were no plans for those two major events, the recession.
No, I did not plan for those. That's correct.
In retrospect now, since there were no plans, no blueprint on what to do next, is there anything that you had to decide in a hurry that now you say, boy, I would have done that differently?
Well, there were a lot of decisions that were made quickly, but if I look back on those decisions, I feel very, very good that we made good decisions. We wouldn't be as far along in flood recovery if we hadn't been making good decisions. We probably – some of the critical decisions made during the flood were – and I had to make this one. We would be open for summer school a week after the flood. I felt it was important for people to have some sense of normalcy given what we'd been through, and that if they stayed focused on we would be open not only for summer school, but we would be open for the fall – that would give us a sense of purpose that would get us through much of the initial stages of the crisis, and I think it did.
You say you're emerging from these two challenges stronger, but you know the recovery from the recession is still very, very fragile.
Oh, very, yes.
And that all affects the University of Iowa. Do you anticipate that there might be continued expense reductions, academic program review is possible, further reductions, increased tuition and fees to students, charges for services that now Iowans get from the University of Iowa without charge that there may be charges for in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's probably too soon to lay out the explicit roadmap of how this might look in the future. But what I can tell you and what I've learned in my 3 years at Iowa is that this university is one that is constantly looking for ways to be more efficient. It probably goes all the way back to the farm crisis and before that. So when you're in a resource-challenged environment and you're always looking for efficiencies, when you have opportunities thrust upon you, like the recession has thrust upon us, you really go into high gear. Yep. We're always going to be looking for ways in which we can do our work better and more efficiently. And I think going forward, it's wise and prudent, given, as you say, the fragile nature of this recovery, to certainly continue planning in a very frugal environment.
What's the status in restoring the campus from the ravages of the flood? I know the music and art students have been sort of displaced and into an outlying area away from the campus, and that's just part of what's going on. But are you seeing, I mean, things getting brighter and that you can say that things in the next year are going to be different?
Oh, yeah, very much so. In fact, we have an architect selected, I think, as people know, for the new art building. Stephen Hull is going to design the new art building. He designed the Art West building and won awards for it. So we expect great things from Stephen as we go forward on that project. The location for Hancher Auditorium is now set, and this fall we'll have selection of an architect for that project. And I presume and hope, obviously, that we'll be moving along with the music school similarly.
When Hancher Auditorium and where?
Hancher Auditorium will be on the west side of campus near the Levitt Center. Mm-hmm. We've got a large site there that an architect can work with, and obviously we'll have an architect selected, I believe, early fall, probably September.
That's a site just up the hill from the old Hancher
exactly.
building.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And a beautiful river location, so you still get the lovely views of the river, but further up out of the floodplain.
There's another challenge that you've thrown your full weight of the presidency, the bully pulpit, if you will, of the presidency behind now, and that is changing the culture of alcohol abuse
Correct.
In the Iowa City downtown campus town area. Do you consider modifying that culture a priority in the future of the University of Iowa? Would you put it that strongly?
Absolutely, and it's an issue of health and safety. As I've had the opportunity to spend some time seeing what goes on in Iowa City, and I certainly didn't have the full picture when I first came on board, but I feel more confident now that for the health and safety of our whole community, including our college students, reducing binge drinking and the unsafe kinds of behavior that come along with that is an absolute priority.
And you have a partnership now with the city of Iowa City and maybe others.
We do. We do, and I think that's really important. That partnership has provided us with a lot of momentum and a lot of impetus to try and make some critical changes here.
There's a new ordinance in Iowa City. A lot's been said about allowing people under 21 years of age in bars after 10 o'clock at night. But there's a petition that has put it back on the ballot for rescinding of that ordinance. It'll be voted on in November. You've already said, and this is a contrast to the last time around when there was an ordinance and it was rescinded, and you were neutral that time. You have taken a stand this time and said, I'm firmly behind the 21 and under ordinance
Absolutely.
Being on the books. But I'm asking now, is that a personal view of yours? Or are you putting the weight of the University of Iowa behind a campaign to keep that ordinance in place?
As far as the ordinance goes, it is both personal and my view as the university president that this is important. I've always tried to very carefully navigate when there are voter issues, to not take a stance on voter issues, and that was part of my thinking as we went through the first time. And I'll be very careful in my comments. I support the 21-only ordinance, absolutely, and I will throw whatever weight I can behind it to make certain that we continue to go along with what was intended by that ordinance in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Are there other things that you're going to be doing in changing the culture? And I'm thinking about the tailgating. Comments have been made that around Kinnick Stadium, we're not setting a very good example as a university in how we enforce alcohol policies there.
Yeah. Stay tuned. I think you're going to hear more about that. I think that indeed there are some individuals who abuse the great atmosphere, family atmosphere that we have during tailgating, and we want to see some of that cleaned up. And I think we're going to be taking some steps to try and deal with that as well.
How soon?
Very soon, probably starting as soon as this fall.
In other words, we will see some changes for tailgating during the fall football season.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Be a little more explicit on that?
Not at this point. Stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Beginning in fall semester, you're expecting record or near record. Is it overall enrollment or just freshman enrollment?
Certainly, this will be the largest freshman class that we've ever seen at the University of Iowa. That will push us up over, more than likely, any enrollment we've seen before.
But fewer faculty?
A few fewer faculty, although the faculty were not encouraged as much to retire, and so we've not lost as many faculty as we have staff, and that was intentional.
What do you say to incoming freshmen and their parents about coming and expecting larger classes than when they first applied?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me put larger class in perspective. Class sizes may move from 22 to 24. Large is sometimes a matter of perspective here. And again, we have to do that because we are working with fewer resources, and fewer resources means fewer staff, probably fewer temporary faculty, fewer lecturers, fewer people that help support our faculty and our graduate students who do an awful lot of the teaching here, as they should.
Are you also anticipating, I know you have cut some departments entirely, have you not, or merged some and reduced?
Administratively, yes, administratively.
What does that mean?
Well, administratively, it means that what our provost was trying to do was to smaller departments, if they can share administrative resources like secretaries and other kinds of assistants, that's really where the cuts have been made. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, we've not cut any departments entirely. We are looking at some graduate programs that are seriously under-enrolled for eventual elimination, but that's also a process that the faculty are very much involved in, and we're not quite at the point yet where we make full statements about which of those programs might or might not be with us for the long term.
We'll continue the conversation in just a moment, President Mason. Take a quick break now. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. The Exchange continues. I'm Dean Borg, and I'm talking with the president of the University of Iowa, Sally Mason. President Mason, we were talking just before we took the break about the changes in the University of Iowa, academics and so on. What about future enrollments, though? You know, you're rolling along here right now, on a roll. Record enrollments, you know, large freshman classes. But at the most recent Regents meeting, Regent Gartner, Michael Gartner, made a quick observation when you were proposing a new dormitory at the University of Iowa, and he, just in a quick observation, said, I don't see the graduating classes in Iowa high schools being that large in the future. You're going to have some empty dormitory space in the future. Is that the way you see it? Is that worry you?
Well, it would concern me if I thought that we only draw students from Iowa. We take every qualified Iowa student who applies, and Regent Gartner is absolutely right that demographic is not growing. In fact, it's shrinking. So we've taken steps to make certain that we are attractive to students not just in Iowa but all around the world. We're very, very appealing to Illinois, We're very pleased that we're appealing to students in Illinois who have the University of Illinois can't take them all. And we're happy to see such bright and qualified young people from Illinois wanting to come to Iowa City. And a large number of our students do come from Illinois. Similarly, on the international front, we're seeing more and more international students show an interest in Iowa. It adds tremendously to our diversity, and I think it really makes an Iowa education, especially for Iowa kids, more valuable.
In fact, you actively recruit out of state, do you not?
We do.
Yes.
Absolutely we do, and that's not going to stop in the future. And that's part of the reason why I think Regent Gartner's observation is absolutely on target. It's not something that keeps me awake at night, at least not at this point. As long as we keep up the good recruiting efforts and we have a quality education to offer at really very affordable price, then I think the University of Iowa will be a strong institution, at least in terms of students wanting to come here.
And that's a point. I remember being told by the father of a student at the University of Iowa, this father was from Chicago, said, University of Iowa is the biggest bargain around. It's the biggest secret around.
Yeah.
No, what you're saying is, does that argue for a larger differential in out-of-state tuition?
Well, you know, we're always very careful as we look at tuition to make certain that we're not doing something that would somehow limit access to the University of Iowa, particularly for Iowa students. We have tried to provide competitive pricing for out-of-state students, and I believe we have. In fact, the tuition increases that Illinois has put in place for its in-state students this year bring our tuition differential between their in-state and our out-of-state level very, very close.
But with the recruiting that's going on with out-of-state and international students, is that a good reason for Iowa taxpayers to reduce support at the University of Iowa?
Well, I hope not, because a large number of these students actually stay in Iowa and contribute to the tax base as taxpaying and working adults when they finish here. Roughly 30% to 40% of these students stay in Iowa. I think it's a good thing, because otherwise the demographic is shrinking in a way that should concern Iowans.
I want to switch now to athletics. And we recently, in the Big Ten Conference, the Big 12 and the Pac-10, there was some musical chairs going on there.
Indeed.
University of Iowa wasn't directly involved, but were you watching that intently as to what effect it might have on the University of Iowa?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, we are involved in the sense that we're a full member of the Big Ten Conference. And if I could say just a couple words about the Big Ten Conference that distinguishes it from every other athletic conference in the country, and it's why I think Iowa and Iowans should be proud that we're in the Big Ten Conference. Two things in particular. One is that the Big Ten Conference is the only conference where every member is a member also of the very prestigious American Association of Universities. These are the best universities in the country, 63 of the best public and private universities in the country.
So it's not just an athletic conference.
Oh, no. And in fact, when discussions of conference expansion were going on, academics was at the forefront of those discussions, and maintaining that peace at the forefront was important to the presidents in particular. Similarly, we're the only athletic conference where revenue is shared by all of the institutions who are members of the conference. So, in other words, what Iowa gets is the same as what Michigan gets, or Ohio State, or Penn State, or any of the other members of the conference. There's no other athletic conference that does that either.
And when you say revenue, you're talking about athletic revenue. There's no other revenue that comes to this University of Iowa.
Through the Big Ten Conference.
So, as a result of athletics.
As a result of athletics, and particularly as a result of now the Big Ten Network.
How did you view, then, the expansion of the Big Ten? Is it good for the University of Iowa, or are there some negatives?
I believe that it's good for the University of Iowa. Again, adding a single team at this point in time, also a member of the AAU, with similar kinds of athletic traditions to the Hawkeyes and to the Michigans and Ohio States and Penn States of the world, I think this is a great addition to the Big Ten, and we're very, very pleased that that Nebraska was willing to make an application.
Do you at all fear that universities, UI included, to become more concerned with sports revenue than producing world-class scholars?
No, and largely because we keep those two things very separate. Our athletic department and our athletic director knows that in order to run the programs that he wishes to run, he's got to generate revenue and do it without using tuition dollars or taxpayer dollars in the form of state appropriations. Not every school, certainly not every conference, can have that opportunity, but we're very fortunate at the University of Iowa and being part of the Big Ten Conference that we can do it here.
President Mason, at one time there was talk of developing a state university in Western Iowa. That didn't happen. But the University of Iowa, do you have any alliances with community colleges or others that do serve Western Iowa, even though
we do
university on the eastern side of the state?
We do. In fact, we have some great partnerships out there, Sioux City in particular, where the community college out there and the University of Iowa are now offering four-year degrees. The community college will do the first 2 years in nursing, for example, and we'll do the finishing 2 years in nursing right in place in Sioux City. So you don't ever have to leave your home, basically, to be able to earn that University of Iowa degree. And we're going to develop more of those.
Are all those linkages through community colleges or are there others?
Right now, we're working largely through community colleges on the degree offering opportunities. But we have health clinics and we have health care opportunities in communities all across Iowa as well, including out in the western parts of Iowa.
You know, the community colleges enrollments are burgeoning. And is it in the university's best interests to provide a seamless access to the universities from community colleges? And how are you doing that?
Yes, it is. And I think we've got some great examples, certainly in recent years, of the number of transfer students coming to the University of Iowa. We're going to see it again this fall. That number just continues to grow because we have worked to make this much more seamless. It's a lot easier now that we have good partners and partnerships with the community colleges to know exactly what their curriculum looks like and to be able to transfer those credits without issue to the University of Iowa.
Would you like to see, I mean, community colleges seem to be more popular. They have a lower tuition than the state universities. And there are other attractions, too, the nearer home and easier commutes and things like that.
Right.
Would you like to see that sort of a system develop more fully in Iowa, whereas the community colleges are the feeders into the universities?
Yes, to the extent that it's possible. And where it's not possible, in other words, where it's not possible for students to be able to come to Iowa City, we're going to reach out to them and try and develop more distance opportunities and opportunities directly with the community colleges to allow them to get that four-year degree from the University of Iowa. So hopefully it'll be a win-win for those who are really place-bound, that truly can't leave their job or their family and their communities.
That's my conversation with University of Iowa President Sally Mason, recorded earlier this week. Coming up on the program, host Catherine Perkins brings us a conversation with Dallas Tonsiger, the Undersecretary for Rural Development with the United States Department of Agriculture. They'll talk about the Environmental Protection Agency's recent decision to delay implementing an increased ethanol blend in gasoline from 10 to 15%. And they'll also talk about the spread of broadband internet service throughout rural areas in Iowa. And finally, too, a discussion about how federal economic stimulus funds are being spent by the USDA Rural Development. Monday at this time, join us for a special holiday edition of The Capital Steps, Politics Takes a Holiday. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dean Borg, and we're back after this break.
This is The Exchange. I'm Catherine Perkins, also sitting in for Ben Kiefer this hour. Coming up next week on the program, we listen back to a conversation about Methland, the death and life of an American small town, with author Nick Redding, who documents the methamphetamine epidemic in Olwine, Iowa. Then the commercialization of religion. You can see it everywhere, from board games to After the Last Supper mints and Wiccan Barbie. But is it good or bad, or does it simply tell us something interesting about the times in which we're living? That's coming up Wednesday on The Exchange. Now we turn to rural development. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack last week issued a report that outlines the production and consumption capacities of biofuels across the country. I spoke with Dallas Tonsager, USDA Undersecretary for Rural Development, and asked him to share some of the conclusions contained in the report.
Well, the general focus of the report is to trying to be forward-looking and looking at the economic opportunities, the economic challenges, and suggesting some paths that we should probably consider following to get there. We have this national goal of getting to 36 billion gallons of biofuels by the year 2022. And the report suggests some directions to consider, some ideas, some focus that USDA is trying to bring to the discussion about this. And I think it is incredibly important because it gives us all a debate point, so to speak. We make the case in the report for these directions. We hope the public looks at that and gives us feedback. We think there's an important dialogue that has to occur for us to get to that really significant goal that really, I think, can change rural America.
One of the things that was mentioned in the report is that production capacity exists or is being built to reach the goal of having 15 billion gallons of that 36 billion gallons come from cornstarch ethanol. Isn't one of the steps that's expected to drive demand for ethanol the requirement to increase the blend in fuel from 10 to 15%?
I think that it's an important step if EPA makes that decision to move forward with the blend rate. I do think, however, beyond that, we need to be looking at how we grow the market for ethanol, both first and second generation ethanols particularly. And within that issue, we have the access for customers to get blends that are higher than 10 or 15%. And I think the report does a really good job of outlining the case that we need to give a focus on that infrastructure that allows for more consumers to get more access to biofuels and take advantage of the opportunity.
Now, you mentioned the EPA making the decision to increase that blend, and they are, as we know, considering the step. But one of our senators, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, has accused the agency and, in fact, the Obama administration of dragging its feet on this issue. Are they dragging their feet?
No, we think as an administration, we've had as aggressive a posture as you could imagine on biofuels. The Secretary of Agriculture, myself, lots of other folks in the administration have looked aggressively for every way we can help maintain and grow the corn-based ethanol industry, as well as the new cellulosic industry. So I don't think saying that we're dragging our feet is fair. I think the EPA has considerations it has to look at on the decision it's trying to make. But, you know, we're hopeful they're going to make a good choice on this, and we're going to keep moving forward. But I think even beyond their decision, we need to think about those other things we can do to go further, to make sure the markets are bigger, to make sure the opportunity to develop these new industries exists, and really to be very strong advocates.
Are there obstacles to increasing that blend?
Well, I think the EPA is looking at the issues relative to engines and other matters. The position we take at Rural Development is whatever the rules are, they are. Our job is to go out there and assert every day the importance of biofuels, the opportunity of biofuels, to look for the tools to help develop biofuels. And so they have their considerations they have to make, but we feel strongly that it's we have to assert ourselves whatever direction they move. We want to be out there campaigning for the development of this biofuels industry.
Do you know when you expect a decision?
I think the what I have heard is this fall, and I don't have a more precise date than that.
What potential would you look at there and see in Iowa for increasing, and I know we need to talk about demand as well, but for increasing production of biofuels?
Well, I think there's huge opportunity. Obviously, Iowa has a really well-developed corn-based ethanol industry. I think we're looking at all kinds of base feedstocks all across the U.S. To try and grow this industry globally, so to speak. There's five different centers across the U.S. that are being created to study various kinds of biomass to look for this broad source. I think for the corn ethanol industry as well as the second generation industry, having a national program that involves biofuels production in almost every state is an incredibly important step to take for the stability of the whole industry. So I think Iowans who have been engaged in corn ethanol also have the chance to look at these other sources of materials to be used, and I think they really gain from the opportunity of having a national industry that we advocate for in the roadmap package that was put out. I think it's good for everybody. And as we look at strategic issues for the United States, we need to get to the point where the availability of fuel generated in other countries can't be used against us as a lever. And many countries don't do that, but we do have countries that choose to make it a lever from time to time against our national interests. We need to develop this national industry that has the capacity really to start to outweigh the needs of oil generated in places that really don't care about the U.S. or don't see it as important.
As we move beyond corn, what should people be looking to in that next generation of biofuels?
Well, we think that coming together to form the businesses necessary to create that generation is really critical. And you have to look at all the components that have to come together, including the economic ones, to be economically viable. We hope that opportunity will be given to people in rural areas to invest in these plants, assuming they see them of value, of importance. So I think we need to look at everything. As we recall the creation of the corn-based ethanol industry, we need to look at the components that need to come together in the same kind of way that they came together for the corn ethanol industry, and that is stable supplies of feedstocks, of good availability of water and other energy sources, transportation issues. So I think we all need to look for opportunities, and we think those opportunities are going to come, and we want to work with everybody we can to identify the tools we need to go forward.
Now, in Iowa, we saw soy biodiesel plants close or idle production over the past year because they couldn't be profitable. What can USDA or the federal government more generally do to ensure that all Iowa's plants continue to operate and turn a profit?
Well, I wish there was a quick, direct answer for that. I think in the development of any really good business plan, looking for those items that you can count on and have a good confidence in is important. And so I think the more we work together with existing plants, you know, we're very concerned about the biodiesel plants and their status, but the more we can work together to identify the challenges, the opportunities, and when the projects come together, make sure there's adequate capital to see them through difficult times, try and create as stable an environment as possible for the economics to work. I think over the long run, we have to think about stability and grow the industry thoughtfully and look for those places where there's the greatest economic opportunity. We're disappointed for the biodiesel industry that has struggled through difficult times, and we're anxious to see if we can be helpful to them.
Does that mean extending tax credits as well?
Well, of course, Congress has to make that choice and act, and that tax credit is a very important element of that.
When you look at the political landscape, do you think the political will exists to do that?
I can't make a good judgment for that. I wished I could. I know there's a proposal in Congress to do what is there, but I can't speak to whether or not or when that might occur.
You know, biofuels boosters in the Iowa legislature tried unsuccessfully to pass a state mandate for biofuels in the last session. If we can't pass a mandate here with so much at stake, I wonder whether the rest of the nation is ready for more biofuels production.
Well, I believe they are. I think they're looking for the opportunity to use biofuels. I think, again, going back to an earlier part of our discussion, we have to present Americans with more opportunities to select to use biofuels. And currently, I believe there's only a couple thousand fuel stations in the United States that offer the opportunity to get greater than a 10% blend of biofuel. And so we have to work on that infrastructure that really enlarges the pipe, so to speak, or makes it more available. So we all, those of us who support biofuels, I think have to make the case every day about how important they are. We have to look for the ability to get greater access to the biofuels. And, you know, we have to think about the economic competitiveness of it as we go forward. So there's a lot of challenges. There's no question. But I do think Americans understand and recognize the environmental challenges of the existing oil-based world, the economic challenges, the strategic challenges of much of the oil coming from countries that might not necessarily agree with us and use that oil for that purpose. So I think it's there, but I do think we have to go out and press every day and move everything we can to create a situation that works.
Do you think the oil spill has changed the picture?
I think the oil spill has really brought home to people the environmental challenges associated with oil. And if you think about it, you know, what ethanol spill ever did environmental damage or held us back economically across the world? When you produce something locally, when you have something that's, if we do our jobs well, we'll be there every day, then you really do have, I think, accomplished a major strategic shift in people's thinking. And so the oil spill, I'm sure, has had an impact on how people think.
Now, you mentioned the infrastructure needs to be put in place so that more people have access or can get higher blends of ethanol. What kinds of infrastructure needs to be put in place?
Two pieces that are really important. One is automakers need to put E85 chips in as many cars as possible. I think there's something like 6 million cars today that have E85 capacity. Well, obviously that number has to grow so people have the mechanics in their car that allows them to use a higher blend rate. The other is blender pumps and the associated delivery of fuels to gas station to make them available. So I think giving a focus to those key things is the best opportunity the industry has to grow into the 2020 timeframe and really get to those targets and goals that we hope are meetable.
Now, I understand Secretary Vilsack spoke about biotechnology and bioprocessing at the BioCongress this week. Can you tell us what potential he sees for job creation in this sector?
I know he's referenced some studies that point to a very significant increase of jobs over the course of the coming 10 to 12 years. I think the number is something around 800,000 that are direct and indirect jobs that could occur by one study over that time frame because of the development of the biofuels industry. So, you know, that's a big number, and it takes lots of capital and lots of effort to get there. But as we look at what's happened in our economy over the last many years, our rural economies, we need to build local industries in rural America that have stability and create these jobs. If not, we're going to be doomed to kind of the repeating the challenges of the past.
I'm glad you mentioned capital because I saw some excerpts from a presentation that you gave in South Dakota last year in which you talked about the economic stimulus package effectively doubling your budget while staffing has stayed essentially the same. Has that caused any delays in distributing funding in rural areas?
In some cases, you know, we have to develop new rules and regulations in a lot of cases, so that there was timing issues associated with that. I do believe my staff has worked a huge amount of overtime to get the funds out. We believe we will use all the funds allocated to us by the end of this fiscal year when the program ends. So there's been challenges in any organization when you're basically dealing with twice the volume. You really don't have an opportunity to hire additional resources. So you go out there and you want to do good loans, good grants. So it's been a challenge. But we do believe we've met the objectives laid out for us by the president, and we believe that we're going to have a dramatic impact on rural America by getting these grants and loans out the door.
And how much money are we talking?
Our normal program level in a given year is probably a bit over $20 billion. It's almost twice that for this past 18 months altogether. So it was more than 1 year was the period since the enactment of the Stimulus Act until September 30th of this year.
So what kinds of projects have been funded through that stimulus money?
We've done a lot of water and sewer programs, basic infrastructure kinds of things, lots of hospitals, clinics, a significant amount of single-family housing projects where we're either financing somebody to purchase a home or helping to finance a new home. Broadband communications has been one of the largest subject areas. We've done one round of financing on grants and loans for broadband projects, and we're getting ready to do the second round, and starting quite soon we'll be announcing projects in that area. We really think that broadband is a fundamental piece that has to be in place for rural Americans to be competitive. And we're trying very hard to make sure we address some of the most challenged areas of the United States in getting them access to broadband.
Could you, for those who might not understand exactly what you mean there, why is it important for job creation in rural communities? What does broadband allow people to do that they couldn't do otherwise?
Well, if people would reflect for just a moment, I would suggest a couple things. One, our grandparents and great-grandparents built a national rural electric system. They did it by creating cooperatives and by going to the most remote parts of the country and making sure everybody had electricity. If we had not done that, rural America would not be the place it is. The same thing is true of rural water systems. I mean, we've gone to large extents to build systems that allow people access to just basic water supplies. And that has been a hugely important success story for rural America. Well, broadband's much the same way. If you do not have the ability to connect to national and international markets, if you can't connect to the systems that's going to be helping us with healthcare reform and medical records, if you can't provide access to students in local schools to communications, and if you can't give people the same kind of basic access that they have in urban areas, then there becomes less of a reason for them to be in rural America, and we certainly don't want that. We want rural Americans to stay in place. We want the population to grow in rural America, and so we've got to make sure that they get the same kinds of basic access that most urban Americans are used to every day.
Some of the reports that I've read show that almost 93% of communities in Iowa have access to one or more broadband providers, but only about 66% of residents report using broadband at home. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us one thing. Iowa's done a really good job of making sure there's access. So I think that's a remarkable thing that you've done in your state, and our good secretary here had a big part to play in that over the years, I suspect. I think it also tells that there is people who select to use it or not. And contrary, I guess, to my previous choice where everybody, or discussion where rural electric is basic, it's in every home that needs it, rural water is the same way, or hopefully covering a large percentage, broadband is a selective choice. And so while I'd love to say that every rural citizen wants broadband at this point, some don't. Some don't understand what it means to have it or really feel they don't need it or can't afford it. So it tells us that as we do these projects, we do have to look at affordability. And we could build broadband everywhere, but some places it would cost people hundreds of dollars a month to have access to it. So I think it tells us the programs we're trying to do look at affordability and try to create situations in each region where people have an opportunity to access it. 66% of people using it, that's a pretty big number. I mean, we'd like it to be all of our citizens, but having such a, you know, almost two-thirds of the people of your state using broadband every day, you just think about that from 5-10 years ago when it virtually didn't exist.
So overall, how do you think Iowa is faring as far as rural development?
I think Iowa's done exceptionally well over the years because I think they've had brought a real focus to the idea of economic development. As a state, they've made a lot of choices and commitment of resources to help all the communities in the state. I know they have had some challenges in some communities. I've had the chance to travel in Iowa a few times since I've been undersecretary and met with some of the people in the communities where they're still looking for their opportunity. But I also get the chance to travel in most states, and I think Iowa has done particularly well in its work as a community. If you think of Iowa as a community, while we all debate with each other, Iowa's done a pretty good job of coming together and making real commitments in several areas.
Mr. Undersecretary, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh, my great pleasure. I'm a big public radio fan, and so I'm excited about the chance to visit with you all.
That was Dallas Tonsager, USDA Undersecretary for Rural Development. I spoke with him earlier this week. You can read the USDA's report on biofuels and meeting the renewable fuel standard goals at usda.gov. The Exchange is produced by myself, Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, and Alex Hoyer. Technical support comes from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Catherine Perkins. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.